The next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing executives, from leadership and strategy to emerging technologies. And we bring these topics to life by interviewing leading experts in their fields. The next CMO is sponsored by Plana, makers of the world's first AI-based marketing leadership platform, and hosted by me, Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, along with my co-host, Kelsey Kraft. In this episode, Kelsey and I speak to Jeff Coyle, the co-founder and chief strategy officer at MarketMuse, an AI content intelligence and strategy platform. Jeff is also a 20-year veteran of the content industry. We talk about topics like who should be on your content team, how do you measure the business value from the content you're developing, how do you deal with content across media types, and how do you actually repurpose the content from one media type to the other. We also talk about live audio formats like Clubhouse and how they fit into your content strategy. And finally, we touch on some of the new AI-based tools like First Draft from MarketMuse and GPT-3 and discuss how these automated content generation platforms are affecting the world of content. I hope you enjoy the show.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Jeff. I'd love to learn a little bit more about you and what you do at MarketMuse.
Hi, I'm Jeff Coyle. I'm the co-founder and chief strategy officer at MarketMuse. And MarketMuse is a content intelligence platform, really sets the standard for content quality. So we inform teams on what they should be creating, what they should be updating, expanding, optimizing. And we do it, you know, by evaluating what it means to be an expert and nearly giving advice that really, you know, tells the story of expertise, tells the story of authoritativeness, really tells a story about what it would mean to, you know, provide trusted insight with your content. My background, I've been in the content strategy, search engine optimization, lead gen space for May 1st, actually about 22 years, as scary as that might sound. I worked at a company called the Knowledge Storm, which you might be familiar with, or a B2B technology platform that syndicated the earliest content. So why IBM should be using content to generate leads, right? So we generated millions of leads per month with our platform. We have about 250 websites. We were acquired in 2007, worked with TechTarget. I ran their in-house team, focused on, you know, if traffic went through the network, that was something my team probably was responsible for. The interesting thing and why I tell that story is because that was my first experience working with a really high quality, strong editorial team. And so what they were doing was relying on their expertise to build great content. And what I walked in the door saying is, you should use data. And what I didn't know was exactly how to get that data to them in a way that would make sense to them and also be something that they would be inclined to adopt. And, you know, the first versions of that were like spreadsheets with words in them. And they were like, what do you know about those topics? I've been writing about this topic for 20 years. And over the course of that experience, I realized how manual content strategy is and how focused, how reliant on subject matter experts only to drive decisions it was. And like processes that would take 30, 40 hours to make an even remotely decent decision about what to create, what to update. And in the tail end of that time, I met my now co-founder, who had been one of the persons who in this world who was thinking about automating or semi-automating some of this research with artificial intelligence. And the first time I met him, he had taken a process that was about 30 hours for me to do, a topic modeling process to say, if I were an expert and I were covering a topic comprehensively, how would I do that? He had taken that workflow down to 2 minutes and it worked. And I was like, oh, after implementing it and realizing it worked, I jumped off the ship and became co-founder of MarketMuse. And since then, we've just been to the races and growing and building a platform that really informs great decisions for marketers.
Let's go way up now, and we're going to come way back down again to orient our audience a little bit. And because obviously you've got some amazing background and experience in content. Maybe you can start by just outlining what are the key elements of a content strategy for our listeners so they can understand what should be inside this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like to think there are certainly things that are ways that you can get your team aligned and that everybody's on the same page on the overarching business strategy. And that has to connect to the content strategy. I think the more actionable parts of a content strategy that I'll mention relate to ways that people would think about why they would write. And the way that I like to break that down is to, sometimes you're just having to put points on the board. What is our quickest wins? If we were to knock out one page today or update a page, what would that be? The one that would have the biggest impact on a particular KPI. That's the core of strategy from the quickest wins. But you also have more of the business plan. So what's the goal? The goal-based plans are more like, I want to own this topic. Or I want to be the standard for thought leadership in this category, or I want to perform really well. And because I know that if I generate leads in this area, what are the content items I need to create or update that I have that would get us closer to that goal? The third one is really related to risk. And this is the one that really gets forgotten, I think. It's risk-based planning. And you have to allocate time and people for this. And it relates to maybe you have over-reliance on a page or a collection of pages. I'm making a lot of your listeners cringe, but I'll say this. What if one of your pages gets 60% of your traffic or generates an outsized percentage of your leads? What do you do to alleviate that risk? And a lot of people just kind of hope it doesn't go away, or they don't know exactly what to do. But the other one is competitive risk. So when a competitor, a direct competitor or a publisher competitor or aggregator competitor starts publishing in your zone and you don't have a reaction for that, those are some components of planning. And the last big one I'd say is more organizational planning, where you may be in a marketing services org, or you may be on a team that doesn't have enough budget and you're taking orders from other teams. Go write this article. The CEO sends you a proposal. Someone sends you a hacky brief that was made in a spreadsheet and says, hey, go write this. Or you only have the resources to write 5 articles and they're all spoken for until November. One thing that a content team can do, or a content strategy team can put together, is how do we put our best foot forward even if all we're doing is taking orders? So then next year, we're going to come out and say, hey, we knocked it out of the park and we didn't even get to do the creative things we know we should do to achieve our goals or to hit quick wins. So, you know, the key elements are to really think about how you are organized already. What do you actually get done? Is it more aligned to risk? Is it more aligned to quick wins? Is it more aligned to plans? Or are you just taking orders? And that really takes up, that's about 90% of teams and plans that we build are can be classified in one of those 4 groups.
I would love for you to walk us through with our listeners what that content team would look like. What is that strategy? What is that planning? Lay the land out for us.
So what I like to say is kind of from a team structure, a strategist needs to own why you build. It needs to own the reasons why we exist, what we're putting out there to the world. Who are we? Like, I'm the mirror tuner for the website. Like, everyone, hey, everyone in the organization, here's what we're telling the world with our content. We are experts over here. We have never covered this, but we sell products in this space. You know, again, really go through that. And that's the role of the strategist, to get everybody aligned on who you are today, who you want to be, and where's that gap. But then you've got team members who might be in the content management, content marketing, even demand gen and editorial, who have responsibilities for various stages of, I call it, the content life cycle, which would be research and planning, like prioritization. You've got briefing, potentially you have a content brief process, and then the creation and editing, and then the post-production, or the production quality, and then optimization, post-publish optimization and updates. So all your people need to be aligned to what areas of that content lifecycle are they responsible, and are they technology enabled, or is it just coming out of their brain? And that's really the spirit of how we like to organize teams and say, are all those people aligned? Do they know what part, do they know how much work is optimal for them to do? And are they using technology to enable them to be faster and to improve the bottom line number that we always look at? You'll probably dig this. It's content efficiency. So for every article I write or update motion that I make, did it hit my goals? Did it create long-term value? Did it create the value that I expected?
So what's the ultimate business goal that you should tie your content strategy to? How do you make that economic chain work between writing content and delivering profit?
Yeah, I think that there's the part, I'd say the immature way of doing that. And sorry, I'll offend so many people with that word. The immature way of doing that is to connect it directly to revenue. One page equals N traffic equals N leads equals so much sales on my percentage rate. That seems good, but in practice, it doesn't all add up because content has to have, you have to have the entire buyer journey covered in order to satisfy that the level of authoritativeness so that money page can succeed. So you've got to basically build the foundation across the entire buy cycle such that if somebody is, and also the knowledge, the level of knowledge, a persona group. So someone who's very knowledgeable, someone who's not very knowledgeable on that same topic. You've got to have that entire package, an appropriate package so that no matter where they are in that funnel, even post-purchase, by the way, it's the most common mistake is you don't make content on those topics for people who are already customers, whether it's troubleshooting or champion development or champion engagement. And you to show that you actually know this. So to what end? It's so that when you do publish something, it can be successful. You set yourself up with the foundation so that when you do publish, let's say, a webinar transcript about the topic, it will perform outsized if you had just published that on a brand new website. So you create this foundation so that when you do put out a money page, when you do put out a capture form or a content upgrade, the top of funnel is 20, 30x what it would have been if you hadn't built that foundation. So I like to say it's that I've got a foundation such that no matter what I publish on a semantically related concept, I have a chance to win. I have the existing topical authority. If I don't set myself up for that, I like to say it's a tooth without a mouth. I'm just hoping that it does really well, but it's probably not because there's no infrastructure that allows it to bite down on anything. But yeah, the outcome is that the total collection of content on the topic yields the outcomes that my business relies on.
Jeff, clearly you speak like a language scientist. You're talking about the semantic relation of your topic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I wonder is when you or your customers think about mm-hmm. content, do they think about the words or do they think about the full multimedia experience related to content these days? And if so, how do you find ways to tie those semantic relationships if it's you're trying to bridge words and sounds and pictures into a single integrated topic cluster?
One of the requirements for rich media optimization is we're still in the world where everything gets back to text if you want that to yield organic search performance. So if you've got videos, the videos will increase engagement. The videos and the audios are going to provide value for another type of user, type of learner. The graphics, the slide shares, whatever the multimedia experience, the content upgrades are going to have all these outsized positive impacts. The cool thing about that is that you can take one thing, one artifact, one piece of work, and turn it into a lot of different ways to capture a person's first experience. The negative is they all have to tie back to some text. So you've got to do things like transcription and optimization of that transcript and annotation. Same thing with a podcast or with maybe infographics or other types of graphics. It's all got to tie back and those pages need to be linked together so that the technology that's looking at that can say, oh, these things are all related. This is providing this level of insight. This is providing that level of insight. The repurposing side, though, is one of the biggest unlockers for small budgets to be able to truly do it. And I always say the only way you get it done is by doing it. It sounds so trite, but repurposing is something a lot of people talk about, but it's really hard to say discipline and actually execute it every time the right way.
It's interesting because we tend to repurpose out of necessity, but also there's an optimization opportunity there. And it's timely that you bring this up because literally I wrote over this weekend a blog post that is about how to present marketing results to your CEO and your board. And it was based on a webinar that we did, which was obviously a different kind of content format. And ultimately, it's going to end up in a chapter in the second edition of our book. So we're trying to merchandise the ideas across these different approaches and channels and formats so mm-hmm. that one, we get the most bang for the buck. But I think the more interesting one point is the one you brought up a couple of minutes ago, Jeff, is the concept that people like to consume information in very different ways. And we found that we wrote a ton of content in 2019 and 2020. And then we put it in a book. And when we put it in a book, we actually generated a whole new audience of people who actually are comfortable at, I want to see something in its entirety, and I want to page through it, and I want something physical and all those things. And then some people like podcasts, some people like webinars. So really trying to tell the story across multiple formats is important. But what it makes me worry about for people who are less multi-talented than our massive marketing team, how do you deal with this with a small team? And so we have a very small marketing team. She's on this call. Exactly. But we are getting an intern, right? So we're going to be like massively increasing the team. So the concepts that you're talking about here, Jeff, apply, I think, to sophisticated marketing strategies and approaches. But do they apply also to more simple teams? So can you actually have a content organization of one, as an example, yeah. that's responsible for all those things? And how should you think about that? One, is there this weird mythical beast you have to hire that has all these crazy capabilities? Or are there more sort of tools and supports and outsourcing that they need to think about? If you're a smaller organization and want to build a really powerful content creation, content management capability.
Yeah, and those are great things. And there are technology solutions that obviously I represent one of them, but there's many that will fast track some of the painful manual processes. And that, so I think you can achieve more with a smaller team from a strategic side. I think the three things I'd mention would be to really make sure any manual labor, Kelsey, that you're doing, you document anything that's still manual, where it's something you have to do, you're filling out forms, you're doing research that's manual, you lost time. You got to, if you're a team of one, you got to document your lost time. You got to document your inefficiencies. The other is the record button. And I joke around about this a lot with teams and large organizations. I'm basically saying when you're on the line with Peter, make sure that record button's on. Because that recording, you're gonna naturally just extract expert insight out of every conversation, and that's gonna be inspirational. So then maybe that turns into another 20-minute conversation where you get the full list of common reader intents out of his brain, and then turn that into something great. I also say set the bar high for yourself for repurposing. So basically, when I publish an article, I want to at least do 2 or 3 of this pool of 10 repurposing steps. And if you do that, you'll see your output jump. So it's researching, planning, briefing. If you're writing all the content yourself, you're probably not briefing yourself. But if you are outsourcing too, creating a great brief structure is a must so that you have a single source of truth for your outsourced writers. Because the worst thing you can spend your time on is feedback. It is the biggest drudge of the small team. It's you go outsource writing and you spend time having to go back to them and say, hey, fix this, or you end up doing it yourself. And then the other big dredge on a small team is writing the wrong content, creating content that has no chance to succeed, having the wrong expectations, or updating content in a way that won't make it grow. So the way that you do it as a small team, improve your efficiency so that more content you create and update is going to have an outsized win. It's create a single source of truth if you're outsourcing. And it's make sure you're not doing anything manual and use your subject matter experts to your advantage. There's nothing better than having a day of interviews as a small team that turns into a 20, 30, 40 page package that when you publish it, everyone's going to be like, hey, oh my gosh, Kelsey, how'd you get 40 pages done? It's just, and that's the way you get there. And that's possible.
Yeah, I guess my question for you, and I'm going to relate it back to Plana, we aren't at a point of outsourcing right now, but we are growing pretty rapidly. And the executive team handles a lot of the creating content. Obviously, that's not their only role. They have a ton of other things on their plate. Mm-hmm. When does it make sense to outsource? And what considerations should you figure out before you make that step?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's such a common situation. And I'll ask you a question, Kelsey. How regularly do they hit their goals for content creation that have been set?
If we look at this year, I would say we're behind. If we looked at last year, I would say they did a pretty good job because we needed to create that marketing engine. But I think we're at that point of some of our content plateauing, and we definitely need that content.
Yeah, you've got to get them. You're the bump and the set, and their writing is the spike. You got to get it so that they are doing as little as possible, but the content gets done. And whether that is an editor role or like you are recording and tuning or otherwise, that's the way you can get to those next steps. You got to figure out, I am confident that this is going to be this successful. I am confident in my prioritization and the predictability of these things. We have to get this stuff done. And then also really taking a sharp look at, like I said, your efficiency and then your update cadence. How frequently are you updating and expanding or doing cluster development? Our executive, who's the most prolific writer, knocked out this core page. I'm knocking out a bunch of support pages that I've learned that I need to create from my analysis. And that's where the money's made, just to be blunt, because you go write a great piece, a guide, your executive sponsor, it's knocking, it's crushing it. You're able to go in and look at your leads and go, oh, wow, 60% of the leads that come in here are from the brewing industry. And you go knock out a version of that guide for that target audience and a cluster of content that focuses on their pain points. That's where the money's made for small teams.
That's super helpful, Jeff, and very tangible kind of things that the team can do. One of the things to change gears a little bit that I thought about a lot as we were coming into this conversation is there's this wild expansion in new content formats, in particular live audio coming out. So obviously Clubhouse has created this amazingly probably bubble-like thing, but who knows? It sounds like it's the fleet of the moment where everyone's adding that button onto their thing, obviously, and everyone wants to get into live audio now. But live streaming is different because all of a sudden it's like a live radio show. It's sometimes really messy and stream of consciousness. But how should that kind of format, a live format, factor into your overall content strategy?
Awesome question. And yeah, I didn't know what the heck Clubhouse was at first, but a member of my team really pushed me to get on there. I like the fact that it's hop in, hop out. I do have a Wednesday club that's recurring that does really well in PR, SEO, and content marketing. And what I'd say is that the problem right now is that when you record, the standards for recording are unclear. So if you're going to record a session, it needs to be declared. That actually hurts people's attendance. So there's a yin and the yang there. But overall, from a what should that play is, you need to know the outs, just like a kind of going to a live event or a virtual event, you need to have an idea of what goals you want to achieve. Do you want to expand your network or the people who are attending's network? Are you working on this for specific lead goals? From these things turning into content, it's all currently repurposing. And it's the same style of repurposing that would be the equivalent of a podcast or otherwise. You're basically taking that and you're repackaging it for different audiences. You're describing what happened as if you were reporting on a live event as an attendee. You are taking learnings from these discussions and properly sourcing them as where they came from, but you're adding to them, adding your annotation, your commentary. It's a great inspiration for content. I wish I had all the recordings for every time I was on a live stream or Clubhouse and somebody who was really great at repurposing, because we don't realize how many words we say when we have audio discussions. It's a dramatic amount. And being able to break those things down and turn them into power is an easy path. And you just have to get it done. I've seen a lot of great work done from people writing about Clubhouse streams and working with transcriptions when they were recorded. And that's only going to get bigger and better.
So you mentioned lots of words. Tell me your view of the trade-off between quantity and quality.
There's the succinctness in a writing piece is an exhibition of expertise. Being able to cover a topic comprehensively in a proper length. And when I say proper, it's not stuffed with goo and keywords, and it's not just droning on and you happen to meander across expertise. And that is the key. And that is something that I'm very passionate about. It's actually one of the core areas of our technology that we have two patents on, is being able to define what it means to be an expert on a topic. Succinctness over quantity any day. The challenge is with the transcript, it is your unmolded clay. It is part of that. I call it the seven planes of rich media optimization hell, right? It's you're writing your show notes, you're getting your transcription, you're annotating the transcription, adding links. You're then getting into the repurposing phases. So it's really the Play-Doh that then you have to turn into something. It can be a long, painful, unedited, unformatted blob of text you hope to get something out of. It just basically says your job is to make that not the case and make it sexy and beautiful and fun to read.
It actually takes a lot of work to be concise and thoughtful. The other thing that's interesting that I find makes a huge difference in quality is just, man, having an outline is just amazing. And it's so rare for people to actually write in a structured way. And the reality is you're not writing a novel. You're writing something to impart some information in a lot of cases. And the best way to do that is to have some structure. And of course, the world of content loves that. Having structured, organized, categorized, tagged kind of structure for content makes a huge difference, but it also just produces better stuff at the end of the day, because I think you can be more coherent when you do that.
One thing I'll mention there is that's something that we really focus on. And we build tens of thousands of content briefs with our technology, and we have them that are automagically created, but we also have more of a self-guided brief creation where you're being assisted to create that outline. And having those guardrails is such an accelerator for everyone involved, because not only for the person creating it, who maybe is the one that's ordering the article, if they're creating it and then writing it, it may help them. It may improve their efficiency, but also by creating that source of truth. I like this outline. Hey, writer, add your expertise. Feel free to go by it, add sections. These are the questions that we definitely want to answer elegantly. These are the sections that we feel would hit on all the common or buyer intents. And if you take this, run with it, and then add your own spin on it, it's going to be beautiful. And when we get on that same page as a marketer and writer, everybody's happy. And the worst thing you can have is a situation where a writer writes something, you give it to you, and you're like, nah, this wasn't what I wanted. And that, unfortunately, happens too much still.
It's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about some of the advances that we're seeing in technologies like GPT-3 and some of the NLP technologies out there around fully automated writing. What do you think over the next few years we're going to see? Is it going to be more in the fully independent, just bots writing stuff, or are you going to see an amplification of intelligence model, which is, I think, closer to what you were describing in your last comment?
Yeah, and I think Market Muse First Draft is a competitive offering for OpenAI's GPT-3. So we are the only real two players in that game. And so I'm a little bit biased, but you know, what GPT-3 is, it's definitely the buzz is around these kind of quick hacks, but the real value is in the inspiration. The real value is like inspiring. Hey, this is a shot at a generation that achieves this goal. It's not going to necessarily replace, but what it does replace, and this is, I feel, and this is a controversial topic, but what I think it replaces is the need for truly low quality content. The bar for low quality content just got higher as GPT-3 becomes more mature, as offerings like Market Muse First Draft become more mature. Why would you go out and buy mass quantities of low quality content? So the people that are most attractive to do this as a replacement were likely the ones who were buying low quality content from a writing network in the past. The people who are going to embrace this as a way of speeding up time or giving my subject matter experts more fodder or getting them on the same page, those are the real winners. Those are the people I work with to make sure that they're using these things wisely. And the unique thing with ours technology is we can pass in our brief and it will generate to spec. And that's where we have the unique advantage over OpenAI solution. But yeah, I mean, what's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of examples of booms and busts, people publishing these content items. They are actually low quality, but they're publishing them thinking they're good enough. There's going to be a lot of tears over that. And then there's going to be a lot of innovation that is truly amplifying. No matter how you slice it, if you put low quality content on your sites, it will come to haunt you. And whether it's an automated Mad Libs style solution that calls themselves NLG, natural language generation, or it's something that uses direct access to OpenAI GPT-3 prompts, or whether they have a reseller agreement with Microsoft. If it's low quality and it hits your page, you're in trouble. And you can't do that on a website that represents a business. You can maybe do that if you're an affiliate marketer and you don't care if your site goes to zero, because you can just create a new one. Maybe there's going to be a play there for get the boom and then the bust. But if you're working for a reasonably sized organization and that's your strategy, you're building a house of cards. And that's I'm a person who created one of these technologies. And like really the only one that's better than GPT-3, really, in my personal opinion, biased, obviously, but it's coming from me. Do not do that. It will not have a long-term possibility of success right now. Will I be changing my tune a year from now? I don't know. I hope not. But I hope there's a situation where we're just raising the bar so that no one thinks they can get by with crap, because then I'll be happy. That's actually our mission statement. We have two of them. It's set the standard for content quality, and the other one is rid the world of bad content.
Please, what you said there, Jeff, was interesting, because it seems to imply that there's going to be a stratification of this kind of AI-assisted writing. There's the GPT-3 approach, which tends to be a go find everything that's already out there and reorganize it in a different way that makes some syntactic sense. And then there's the build a new idea. And the build a new idea thing seems like it's not really... It feels like GPT-3, nice, is going to regurgitate a bunch of stuff. And do I have that right?
It's a general language model. GPT-3 is the last time its source was updated. I believe now it's 2019. The actual data source, the content, it's writing text that is not fact-checked. It has a poor long-term memory. It will just start to repeat itself. If you look at it, it has to be stitched together. It's actually a word that people are using now for using NLGs, because you have to do one submission of a prompt to get a little 300 word chunk. Then you do another one and you have to like stitch it together. That is part of it, but it can be tuned for new concepts. It can be post-tuned. What we're going to see, though, is we're going to see new, bigger, badder language models. They're going to keep getting better and better. The speed at which this is accelerating is almost unfathomable. Google has a language model that's 5x GPT-3 already internally. We have ours as well, which is we take a little bit of a different approach. We tune ours for every topic. So we actually create one to be an expert in every concept that we want to cover, and we have a way to fast track that expert creation, the expert writer creation. Where is it going to go? I don't know, but I think the winners are going to be the ones that use it to enhance their skills versus replace their skills. The replacers, if anyone has ever known anything in search engine optimization, is if you think you've got a system that shortcuts, it's going to have a end date.
And interestingly, your description of GPT-3 of not really good at fact checking and repeats itself makes it sound pretty human to me, actually. So that's an interesting evolution of AI. So we're about at the end of our time, Jeff, and I wanted to ask one quick thing and then toss it to Kelsey to wrap up. But just quickly, you've been super generous with your insights here. And obviously, we'd love to know how our audience can learn more about you and MarketMuse.
So I'm Jeffrey _ Coyle on Twitter, on LinkedIn. Please shoot me a note at there or jeff@marketmuse.com. Like I mentioned, MarketMuse is a content intelligence platform that focuses on the topics that we talked about today, really content efficiency. We build briefs at scale, whether you are a small team just outsourcing or you're the biggest publishers in the world that we work with. We have solutions that are self-serve, get in there, do it yourself, hack around, edit content, update content, do competitive analysis, all the way up to providing on-demand content inventories for all of the largest brands, like Alphabet lists type people. So yeah, give me a call or shoot me a note at jeff@marketmuse.com. See if it's a fit.
Great. And with that, I think, Kelsey, we got one more question.
Yes, our favorite question of all. This podcast has been awesome. I'm really excited for our listeners to implement some of these takeaways. But what advice would you give to CMOs or aspiring CMOs?
Oh, gosh. I like to do a status check of how many projects, like I call them pillars, or you can call them plates if you think you're spinning plates. How many of them do you currently have projects being applied? And is that number too many? And if you want to maintain them and they're under-resourced, try to figure out how to resource them or outsource them. I think from my standpoint, the biggest challenge I see with CMOs is you've got 15 plates spinning and you're not focused on but one or two of those projects or those efforts or those KPIs. I think doing it, whether it's a quarterly or a yearly analysis of every type of project you worked on, everywhere you've applied resources, and see if you did something super thin, and try to strive to only do stuff when you're really in the game applying focus. Or if you're not applying focus, you're going to resource it appropriately next time.
Great. Going to wrap up. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for your time today, Jeff. And make sure to follow The Next CMO and Planna on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can email us at thenextcmo@planna.com. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Jeff. Thanks, Jeff.